been a chaplain for 29 years. The first 25 of these years was spent in the Royal Air Force, traveling all over the world and serving with the military community. For the last 5 years, I've been chaplain to the oil and gas industry, a very similar role in very many ways. However, these two readings are readings that I fall back on time and time again because they seem so applicable to the work I've been doing in these number of years, because they seem to strike at the core of the issues I come across. This morning, I don't know much about what's going on in cults and the parish here, so I'm not going to bore you too much, but I'll speak a little bit about the chaplaincy work that I've been involved in and why these readings are so applicable. When I was recruited into the oil and gas industry 5 years ago, I was very acutely aware that the chaplaincy sprung from the response to disaster. In 1986, the Church of Scotland decided that that was the right time to place a chaplain in the burgeoning North Sea oil industry. The church advertised the post, and the first chaplain, Reverend Andy Wiley, was appointed. He spent his first months knocking on the doors of the oil companies in Aberdeen, asking if he could travel offshore. And all the major operators gave him the same response. Not a chance. Why would we want to have religion offshore? In the end, Shell got fed up with these battering on their door, I suppose, and they offered him a trip up to the Brent field. But a day or two before he flew, the industry suffered its worst aviation accident when 45 people were killed when their Chinook helicopter crashed off Shetland, returning from the Brent field. Andy travelled as arranged, and he supported those who had lost friends and colleagues. And Shell and the rest of the industry suddenly took note that actually perhaps having a chaplaincy involvement offshore might not be a bad thing. So after that, negotiations began with the Church of Scotland into how a chaplain might be appointed, who could work for and actually in the industry. Well, those of you who have ever done any negotiations with 121 George Street will know that things aren't too quick. And certainly those who have tried negotiating with a bunch of oil companies will find the same issue. So these negotiations were ongoing and were taking a long time when Piper Alpha came along. And Andy, of course, was heavily involved with the survivors and the bereaved. And that's what actually, in the end, forced negotiations to conclusion. The Church of Scotland and the industry came to an agreement whereby the church would supply a minister and the minister's stipend would be paid back to the church by Oil and Gas UK, the governing body of the umbrella organisation for the industry, which effectively means that the members of Oil and Gas UK pay for their chaplaincy. So myself and my four predecessors, while we were employed as a Church of Scotland minister, we 121, with all the joy that brings, we actually belong to every company working in the oil and gas sector, although I'm still employed as a minister of the Church of Scotland, which is a good place to be, actually. I'm owned by everyone, but nobody runs me. I'm free to do what I like. There are grave limitations to this, though. Chaplaincy, I've found over the years, can be truly effective when it builds relationships. I am one chaplain covering a workforce in excess of 300,000, and I know every one of them intimately. Not. The Norwegians in their sector have a number of chaplains working, and each chaplain covers five different installations, which allows them to get to know their people because they do make their regular visits. It's a similar model to the one that I was used to in the military, where I was based with a unit or a station, and I'd go everywhere with the people that I was ministering to. I think The industry's happy. Well, I know the industry's happy to have a chaplain, but it's not overly concerned about what I get up to on a daily basis, providing the chaplain's always ready to respond to an incident. I'm seeing as another asset in the area of emergency response. And since I began in the role back in 2012, there have been two helicopter ditchings and one crash in the Norwegian sector, which of course killed one of our local chaps. This means that much of my work is spent with those who have suffered major shock or trauma. Thankfully, these days, the accident rate has plummeted, but there are still a number of offshore deaths every year due to natural causes. But these deaths due to natural causes are still wholly unexpected and sudden. They happen away from home, and therefore they come as a great shock to both the families and the crews, the friends around them. My parishioners are all relatively young because they're all working age. And so when calamities happen, actually they hit hard because they're not meant to happen to that age group at all. And I've lost count of the number of times when I've heard the words or the question, well, where's your God in all this? How can we have a God? How can you believe in a God when this happens? And that's where my favourite psalm comes in, the one I turn to constantly, which begins with the words, you know, surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. Because when you look at that psalm, you can just see the psalmist, picture the psalmist wrestling with his own doubts and concerns. The belief round about him was that the good would be looked after, they would prosper, the evil would be the ones who would fail. And as he looked around about him, the opposite was happening. It was the wicked who were prospering and the righteous who were suffering. And it just seemed that God wasn't around. Now, the psalmist, the Psalm 73, isn't the only one to face the problem, because psalms of lament, as we call them, are dominant right through the book of Psalms, which is possibly why we don't hear too much from them these days. You know, why have you cast us off, O God? Is it forever? Why are you so stern, so angry with the sheep of your flock? Not quite go along with our nice, cosy ideas of Christianity. But the Psalms that we read in our books today were actually the hymn book which the people of ancient Israel used. They would chant these words in their worship, and almost half of them are Psalms of lament, which surely suggests that Psalms of this type were used all the time and actually must have been useful to the people when they worshipped God. We know that life there was difficult. The community had to face threats of one sort or another, and the Psalms reflect this. They reflect, perhaps, that something we maybe forget, that in every age, faith can involve a struggle. A struggle to understand the God we come to worship, but a God who at times can be or seem to be a bit absent. I mean, the Israelites were full of struggles. The 587, the Jerusalem was attacked and conquered by the Babylonians. Most of the community thought this would be impossible because they had a strongly held belief, a deeply held belief that God lived with them in the temple. And as long as God lived with them in the temple, well, they were safe. How could anyone defeat them if God was there in their temple, living among them, protecting them? That was the faith. That was their strongly held faith. What happened to that faith when the Babylonians drove up the road and crushed their temple? Where was God there? Their belief was shattered. How could that have happened if God had lived in the temple? They felt God had deserted them. And I'm sure, unless you've been very lucky, there's been some point in your life when personal disaster has overtaken you, and like the Israelites, when we have preconceived notions of God, we tend to think we know how God should be acting. And we forget Paul's famous words, "Now we see but a poor reflection, as in a mirror, but we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully." Because if something happens to us and if our notions get rocked, we can only go in one direction, and that's to start questioning our beliefs, as the psalmist does. And some things in this world do seem at odds with our belief in a loving, caring God. Towards the end of last year, I spent a lot of time with a young family with a 3-year-old child. Dad was a driller, and his rig was one of the many that was laid up, and he was laid off. The 3-year-old child was terminally ill. And shortly after Dad was laid off, his son died. And the family's lives were turned upside down. And amongst the pain and angst, the question of where is God wasn't far away. It's a question which is never far from the lips of those I minister to when they faced a life-changing shock. And I'm going to throw that question to you this morning. Because as members of God's church, his body, if someone going through desperate pain was to ask you that question, how would you answer? Those, if there are any here holding strong Calvinist views, might say, well, it's the will of God. But you know, I don't think telling someone facing their deepest hurt that it was the will of God would bring them the peace of God necessarily. It would very possibly have them kick God out of their lives forevermore. So where is he when these things happen? Perhaps the Psalms can actually help us here. And if, in case you think that the faith of ancient Israel is so different to our own faith, the Psalms can't possibly help, especially in the light of Jesus. Think again, because what was it Jesus uttered when he hung on the cross? My God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22. So I think they have a lot to say to us. Our hymn book is full of psalms. And you know what? They've all been edited. A good example is Psalm 106, and I'm not going to ask you to look it up just now. Do it at home. Check out hymn number 70 in here. When you get home, again, Psalm 106. It's a great example. Because if you look at Psalm 106 in your Bible, you'll find that Psalm 106 is a psalm of lament. You look at hymn 70, taken from Psalm 106, and you'll see it's a hymn of praise. Because only verses 1 to 5 and verse 48 appear in this book. A psalm of lament has been turned to a psalm of praise, and I can't help wondering if we're wrong to presume that worship is meant to be a one-sided affair. Perhaps, just perhaps, if we expressed our worries, our anxieties in worship as the psalmists did, like God's people in the past, the calamities of life might be easier to overcome. When we're in a true relationship with a partner, your partner knows everything about you. Husbands and wives know everything, or should know everything, about each other. They see their good sides, they see their bad sides. They see them when we're happy and sad. Angry too. No husband or wife has ever not expressed anger to his loving or her loving partner when the other's done something to really upset them. But that's what a real relationship brings. But we don't tend to do that with our relationship in God. We hide part of ourselves, I think, at times. We keep something back. The psalmists didn't hold back. When they approached God, they brought their whole selves to him. They got angry, they complained, and they praised the whole gamut. In Psalm 73, the psalmist expresses this problem and he finds an answer. His problem is that the wicked are prospering, totally against the beliefs of the community of the day. In the Old Testament, if you know anything much about it, frequently states that the wicked will never prosper, the bad will go down. But that's not happening here. Our psalmist turns around and says, you know, this is rubbish. The wicked are enjoying peace, and what's more, it's making him jealous. He's trying to do his best to be faithful, to obey the laws, and what's his reward? Well, he writes, surely in vain I've kept my heart pure, in vain I have washed my hands in innocence. All day long I've been plagued, I have been punished every morning. And that raises the obvious question, why believe? Why follow? He works then out the implication of what he's saying. If I'd said, I'll speak thus, I would betray your children. It doesn't stop him puzzling it over in his mind, but the answer finally dawns on him as he walks into God's secret court, the temple. When my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was a brute beast before you. Yet I am always with you. You hold me in my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterwards you will take me into glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And earth is nothing I desire beside you. My flesh, my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. It was in the temple when he worshipped that he saw his problem in a new light. He's forced to recognize that the problem lies not with the fact that the wicked are prospering, but that he doesn't understand what faith means. Why had he been jealous of the wicked? Could it be that he thought that righteousness, faith, being good, should be rewarded? Martin Buber once wrote, always and everywhere in the history of religion, the fact that God is identified with success is the greatest obstacle to a steadfast religious life. Always and everywhere in the history of religion, the fact that God is identified with success is the greatest obstacle to a steadfast religious life. It's the old Sunday school theology, or the theology of the American TV evangelists. Be good, do good, and you're safe. Nothing bad will happen to you. That's not what happens in the real world. People of faith get ill. People of faith die. That's the world. That faith, or whatever we do, doesn't necessarily protect us from that. But through his doubts, the psalmist reached the point of discovering that faith did not depend on his grasp of God, but actually God's grasp of him. I am always with you, you hold me by my right hand, in every situation, no matter where, God is present. Yep, there are times, like the psalmists, like some of those I've ministered to, when we could lose sight of God. If something awful happens, we may all lose our grasp of God. It could happen to any of us. Because if that doesn't fit into our ideas of what he should be like and what he should be doing, we end up questioning. But here's the thing. He is always there. He is always reaching out. He is always holding us in his love. William Barclay, a famous professor at New Testament in Glasgow Uni, once said, in a disaster, I believe that God cries with us. Because he's right by us. He's going through all we go through in our lives. A comforting thought when we're going through a crisis. And to finish this, I'm going to simply remind you of Jesus' last words as recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. Be assured, he said, I am with you always to the end of the age.